Welcome to the first episode of the Wilmington History Society podcast series. My name is Nathan Field. I'm your host today, and I'm here along with Bill Knightley. Before we get started, let me give our listeners some background on the Wilmington History Society. It was founded by Ben Rapkin and myself in April 2018, and we had two goals. The first is to generate more interest in local Wilmington history. We're not Philadelphia, we're not New York, but we do have an interesting story in our own right. The second goal is to promote a stronger sense of local community spirit at a time of great divisiveness and partisanship. We don't claim that history is always pretty, but our goal with this group is to promote just stronger community, and we want everybody that comes to an event or listens to one of our podcasts to feel like they are a part of the same community walking out. Each month since, we've rented the basement bar of the Chelsea Tavern on Market Street and hosted a happy hour speaker on some Wilmington history-related topic. You can find a description of all events on the Wilmington History Society website, which is easy to remember, wilmingtonhistorysociety.com. And two of our most recent include, in January, we had Janet Lindenmuth speak about her research on the role of local Wilmington women in getting the 20th Amendment passed, giving women the right to vote. It was passed in Washington, D.C., and then each state had to ratify it in order for it to go into effect. Janet spoke about six or seven of the local women here in Wilmington that played a role in making that happen. She went into detail about their backgrounds, where they lived, where they went to school. It was quite an interesting event. In February, Bill Freeborn of the Wilmington Land Bank spoke about the role of his organization in finding new purposes for the more than 1,500 abandoned houses throughout the city, each of them built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, historic in that regard, but it's been tough to find new purposes for them in the modern era. By one interesting metric, Bill's talk was a resounding success. A couple of days afterwards, I was speaking with the owner of Chelsea Tavern. He told me that they're going to be cutting off the attendance at future events at 50 people because we are in danger of violating the fire code. We don't want to do that, but I take a little bit of pride in that because it goes to show the growing interest in local Wilmington history. Now, how did we come to start these podcasts? We had Bill Knightley scheduled to be our March speaker on his incredibly interesting research on Wilmington during the Revolutionary War. But meanwhile, people had been asking over the last year or so, have you thought about doing podcasts? And it was always in the back of my mind, but then the coronavirus hit, and we have no idea when we will be able to have in-person events again. So what better time than now, rather than let COVID-19 kill the fun and all the momentum that we had been generating with our events, we're happy to announce this new podcast series. And so what listeners can expect is five or six really good 1 hour or so long interviews, deep dives into local history topics that we're going to be posting in the next month or so. I'm looking forward to it because it's going to enable us to go into much greater depth on some of these issues than we've had during the events. Been cutting off the talks usually at 20 to 25 minutes in the interest of keeping the events, not having them go too late, but many of these topics people could go on for an hour or two or more without running out of new information. Where can you find these new podcasts? Three places. The first is the Wilmington History Society website, wilmingtonhistorysociety.com. The second is our new Facebook page, which if you go to Facebook and type in Wilmington History Society, it should come right up. Please like or follow, and that will enable you to get new podcasts straight to your inbox whenever you open up Facebook. We'll also be posting all new information about future events on Facebook and the website. And the third site is the WilmingtonHistorySociety.podbean.com. That's the actual podcast host. That's podbean.com. And through there, you can download each of these podcasts onto an iPhone or onto any other listening device. With that, let me introduce Bill. So Bill Knightley grew up in Wilmington, just outside the city in Bellefonte. He attended St. Helena's for grade school and then Salesianum. He went on to be a history major at the University of Delaware. And afterwards, he went on to a long and distinguished career in the U.S. Army, rising to the very high rank of colonel. Upon his retirement, Bill moved back to Wilmington, where, amongst other things, he is a professional grandfather. In his free time from that job, he's a very good and passionate amateur historian. Bill has spent the last several years conducting in-depth primary source research on local Wilmington history, especially as relates to the Revolutionary War era. Now, Bill and I were talking about this podcast. We realized that he's actually done so much research, it's too much to cram into one session. So I'm very excited that we have three podcasts with Bill. The first is on today's topic, which is Wilmington during the colonial era. The second is Wilmington during the Revolutionary War. There's a number of subtopics related to that, including the military occupation by George Washington's forces of Wilmington. Another is the Battle of Brandywine. And then the third is on a very interesting topic, which is the 1824 visit by the Marquis de Lafayette to Wilmington. Now, many people will recall that he was a hero of the Revolutionary War. He spent some time in Wilmington. And many years after the war, he came back to the U.S. to visit the spots that he was during the war. One of them was Wilmington. I won't go into any more details, but it's fair to say it was the biggest VIP visit to Wilmington maybe ever. Bill has dug up some incredible details on that. Now, with that, I'm going to stop talking. Bill, how you doing today?
Great. Thanks, Nathan. It's an honor to be on your first podcast, and just add that I'd really appreciate what you're doing to keep history alive in Wilmington.
Well, it's my pleasure to do that and to have you as our guest today. So let's dive right into it. Bill, paint us an initial picture of colonial Wilmington. What are we talking about? Total population of Wilmington? How big is Delaware? And what is the form of local government that we're talking about?
Yeah, you know, the colonial period, you can pick your dates. We'll probably focus from about 1735 on up into the post-Revolutionary War period, let's say into 1800s. This is really the English period of Wilmington. We had the Swedes and the Dutch. So we'll kind of be looking at the English period that started around 1730, 1735, right in there, with Thomas Willing and William Shipley, who that name may ring a bell to people in Wilmington. But in 1735, there were about 600 people in Wilmington, about 30 houses, 35 houses, something like that. Not very big. As you get up towards the Revolution in 1775, you get a little bigger. You get about 1,250 people in Wilmington and about 300 houses. Now, government-wise, when we go back to the early part of colonial Delaware, colonial Wilmington, we were part of Pennsylvania. The whole state of Delaware was known as the lower counties on the Delaware. And the form of government we had was very, very unique in all the colonies. William Penn, who was, everybody knows, was sort of the founder of Pennsylvania, he had a series of counties in what's now eastern Pennsylvania, and then he had, of course, the lower three counties that make up Delaware, and he tried to make them one. And the original assembly met in Chester, Pennsylvania, in the late 1600s, but it really didn't work out for the people of Delaware. Excuse me. So in 1704, Delaware got its own state assembly. Now, we shared a governor with Pennsylvania, but we had our own assembly. And the unique thing about that is that when we passed a law in Delaware, it didn't have to go back to England as did with all the other colonies. We just had to get our laws signed off by the governor of Pennsylvania. Everybody else in the colonies, when they passed a law, since we were part of England, they had to go back to the Privy Council in England to get everything approved. So we had sort of a unique status. So in Newcastle, we had a separate assembly that met just for the lower counties. And that was sort of our form of government all the way up until about 1776, when we had the big break. We had sort of a three-way break. We broke from England, we broke from Pennsylvania, and we broke from the authority of the William Penn family. and that's known in Delaware as Separation Day around the 15th of June. Still celebrated, I might add, down in Newcastle.
Talk a little bit about the geography of Wilmington in this period. You and I both have spent a fair amount of time on Market Street. A lot of people that are listening to this have probably been to the Loma Cafe, which is at 2nd and Market Street. Great cafe. Let's pretend you and I are taking a stroll down Market Street up towards, say, 8th or 9th. We have a time machine. It's 1750, 1760. What are we seeing?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the first thing, let me just say what we're not going to see. We're not going to see any buildings that are connected to each other. And in this period of time, in the colonial period, the buildings were separate. You have to think of Wilmington as a really sort of pastoral setting. Let's go back and look at some first-person accounts, some eyewitness accounts. The number of visitors passed through Wilmington during this period, many of them associated with either the French, the British, or the Continental Army at the time. And I'll read you just a couple of short quotes, and it gives you a really good view of kind of what Wilmington looked like. The first one is from a doctor in 1775, a guy named Dr. Robert Honeywell. He says, quote, "Wilmington is a large place, at least as large as Fredericksburg, Virginia, but much better built, the houses being all of brick and very neat." And, you know, I think the brick houses really stood out up in New England. You know, things were clapboard wood, but here they were, you read over and over again in first-person account that, you know, we had really, really neat-looking brick houses. Washington's own adjutant in 1775, a guy named Thomas Pickering, said, quote, "Wilmington is a pretty town and pleasantly situated." A German who came through in 1881, he was assigned with the French army that went down to Yorktown. On the way through, he said this, quote, "The location of this city is one of the pleasantest and most favorable on the whole continent. The fine houses are all well built, and their surroundings reveal the proper." So it was a pretty impressive place to people that were passing through. I think the most unique description, the most useful description, comes from a guy named Francois Liancourt. He was a Frenchman who came through just after the Revolution, so it still looked a lot like it did during the Revolution. And this is from 1795, and this gives a very specific description of what the city looked like. Quote, "Wilmington, like Philadelphia and many other towns in America, does not cover all the ground marked out for it. The houses, though almost all built in streets, do not join each other. On the contrary, there are fields of considerable size betwixt several of them. They are, in general, handsome, substantial brick buildings, and almost all of them built in the English style. The towns contain about 4 square miles. The town contains about 4 square miles, exclusive of a tract of land not yet built upon," unquote. So the picture we have of Wilmington is sort of a wide open place where there's fences between the houses, there are gardens, there are animals, and it is a town that is built primarily around the Christiana River. And if you move up uphill on Market Street towards what's today is Rodney Square, of course it didn't exist then. Rodney Square at that time was a wooded forest, and the city sort of ended, the town sort of ended around 8th or 9th Street up there, so you really didn't have much up there. If you came down the other side of the hill towards the Brandywine River, you'd enter Brandywine Village, which was a separate town. Didn't join Wilmington until 1869, and that's where all the flour mills are, or were, and two separate municipalities. But Wilmington was open, brick houses, very pastoral.
So none of the neighborhoods that many people think of today as Wilmington existed. So Wilmington is a very small, it's about 4 square miles, would you say?
Well, the total area marked out was 4 square miles, and you had what you'll read in these primary accounts, they refer to squares, and it's not like squares that we think of like in Europe, like a town square. It was just a plot of land where you build a house. So you may have your house on part of the square, and the rest of that square is being tilled for gardens. You might have animals on it grazing, and it was just very, very sparsely populated.
How prominent was Market Street itself, and did it actually have markets?
Well, it was Wilmington's Main Street even then. And yes, we had markets, but the markets, ironically, were not technically on Market Street. They were on the streets that ran perpendicular to Market Street. The main market was on what they called High Street. Now, maybe I should just mention that Wilmington's street names during this period were different. You know, starting at the Christiana River, about the first four streets would be familiar to people today. We had Water Street, Front Street, Second, and Third. But then once you got to Fourth Street, the names totally changed. They weren't numbered. They were given proper names. So Fourth Street was High Street. Then you had Queen on Sixth. Sixth Street was called Hanover Street. Seventh Street was Broad. Eighth was Kent. Ninth was Wood, and there were many other names on up, but they had different streets. But getting back to the markets were on High Street, which is Fourth Street, ran between about Shipley and Market, and they were big. And the markets were absolutely critical to the economic and social life of the city. Now, there was a second market that was built on Second Street, adjoining to Market Street. And back in the early days, the early 1700s, the city was settled by prominent Quakers, the Society of Friends, and they had an enormous influence on the development of Wilmington. But even then, there were factions, and there was a faction in the lower part of the town that wanted a market on Second Street, and then, of course, we had the market on Fourth. And it got so bad that there was just this competition among the two factions, it actually led to violence. And some of the primary sources talk about, you know, attempts to destroy one of the other markets, and it was very competitive. And you can imagine if you had an economic interest in one of these markets, it was probably very, very important to you. So what happened was that after Wilmington became a borough, the borough of Wilmington, and this happened in 1739, you then had a functioning government, what we called burgesses, and then you had a chief burgess who was like a mayor, and they came up with an agreement that they would split these markets. And what they did, at least split the customers or the times people could go to the market. So the upper market on High Street, 4th Street, would be conducted on Saturdays, and the lower market would be conducted on Wednesdays. And then they had two fairs during the year. They had a fall fair and a spring fair. So the market at 4th Street or High Street got the fall fair, and the lower market got the spring fair. And you read about these fairs, they were quite something. People would come from all over the place, and you know, of course, they served alcohol, and things got out of hand. So eventually the town council banned these things in the late 1700s. They just got too much negative publicity, if you will. But getting back to the markets themselves, I got a couple of descriptions. Now, Market Street was not anywhere like we have today. We didn't have the same kind of economic activity. So if you needed things, you went to these markets, and they were absolutely critical. The same French guy that I quoted earlier had this to say. He said, quote, "Wilmington's market is supplied with provisions from the neighborhood. It is held twice a week. It is less than Philadelphia, which it resembles in its marketplace, in the sense of its regulations and the species of provisions sold here. Every necessary is to be procured there and nowhere else in this part of the country." So that's where you went to get just about anything. There's a second really descriptive quote I have here that describes these markets from Benjamin Ferris. And he was a historian and a clockmaker in Wilmington, lived in the late 1700s. Early 1800s, and here's what he says, quote, "Saturday's market groaned under the weight of turkeys, hams, mince pies, and puddings. No town in this country of the extent of Wilmington exhibits such a market. A string of nearly 200 carts and wagons reaching half a mile, laden with pigs, turkeys, geese, poultry, butter, vegetables, eggs, etc., and a long market house filled with noble beef and mutton is to be seen twice a week in Wilmington." So it was quite something, apparently, the market. And no matter where you lived in the sort of metropolitan area, you came into Wilmington to get any kind of manufactured commodity or food, breads, everything. Now, even though the people were semi-self-sufficient on the farms, they still came here to market their goods and to buy things. So the markets, I don't think you can overemphasize how important these markets were. Incidentally, these markets continued for quite some time, and the Market Street on 4th Street was eventually moved to King Street in the 1860s. And, you know, many old people from Wilmington will remember the market on King Street when all the farmers used to back in, and that was the descendant of this market. And so it was, and the original market house that existed on 4th Street was there, I think, until 1923 is when they finally tore it down. It's a shame that, you know, a lot of these old buildings were taken down, but I guess that's progress.
Right. So you mentioned the dispute between the two markets in the colonial era. Did you come across in your research any more information on any more detail about what exactly was at the root of these disputes?
Yeah, I mean, it was all about competition. The people had interest in one market or the other, and they just didn't want the competition. In fact, Benjamin Ferris had a quote. I have it here. This is his quote: "Why two market houses should be built for the accommodation of one market is a question which has often been asked." So it really didn't make any sense for a town like Wilmington to have two markets, but it evolved that way. I've read some things where one of the markets was primarily backed by the Quakers of the time, and the other one by Swedes, the descendants of the Swedes that were still here. But whatever the reason, whoever had the economic interest in each of the markets really didn't want any competition. So that was really the root of the whole thing, is people wanted a monopoly, and the city hall and the city council finally had to get involved and mediate it. Eventually, the Second Street market went away in the late 1700s, and only the one on 4th Street survived.
One question I wanted to ask you is, how did Wilmington get its name? I've heard many, many different versions of this. Is there a historical consensus on this? And is it true that the original name was not Wilmington, but Willington?
Yeah, I mean, it was Thomas Willing who came here in 1731. He was kind of the founder. In fact, there's probably two primary founders, Thomas Willing and William Shipley. But Willingtown took his name. And sometimes you'll hear Willington or Willingtown. You'll see it written different ways. But when Wilmington petitioned King George II to be chartered as a borough, they received that charter in 1739. And when they got the charter, the name had been changed to Wilmington. We know how it was changed. It was changed through the charter process, but we don't know why. And there's a couple of different theories out there and different sources, depending on who you read. One was that the king himself changed the name because Lord Spencer Compton, the Earl of Wilmington, was a very good friend of his. And there's another theory floating around that the governor of Pennsylvania is the one who actually changed the name. It seems that Thomas Willing fell out of favor with people in Pennsylvania because he owed a lot of debts, and they didn't want to name the town after him because his reputation got kind of soiled. So that could be true. I couldn't find a definitive answer. I just know it was changed when they got the charter back in 1739, and there's possibly two reasons why, but it looks like at the bottom of both reasons that Lord Spencer Compton, the Earl of Wilmington, probably had something to do with it.
And it's worth noting that the square next to the library of Delaware History Society is called Willington Square, although that's not from the colonial era. That was named that, I believe, in the 50s or 60s. But people can read about.
I've actually seen a map that was prepared by the Hessian troops that occupied Wilmington after the Battle of Brandywine. Now this is 1777. And on that map, they call it Willingtown. So I guess they were still using those terms as late as 1777, even though the town's official name was Wilmington. So Wilmington was a borough then. It got chartered as a borough, and that gave it a city council, you know, burgesses and a chief burgess and constables, etc. And it wasn't until 1832 it was chartered as a city. And that brought additional authorities to the municipality, like courts and things like that. But yeah, the name, it was definitely changed in 1739.
I want to ask you about media in the colonial era, although maybe media isn't really the right word. To what extent were there newspapers, or to what extent was the average person in Wilmington aware of, say, events that were happening in, you know, Boston with the tax developments that led to the war? Or to what extent was somebody in Wilmington aware of what was happening in Philadelphia?
Well, that's a good question. And the short answer is yes, they were aware of these things. You know, fortunately, Wilmington sat on a major road, the King's Highway, that ran from Boston all the way down to Charleston, 1,300 miles. So you had express riders coming through, you had carriages, you had travelers, visitors. So they brought the news. And they also brought newspapers with them. And remember, now, in the early part of the 1700s, we're still pre-Revolutionary War, we're part of Pennsylvania. So the newspapers produced in Pennsylvania, published up in Philadelphia, were sent down this way, and we were able to read them, or the citizens were. The first newspaper that I know about that was actually published in Wilmington was around 1760. And I think it was called the Wilmington Chronicle. Didn't last very long. And remember, these were primitive newspapers that didn't have, you know, they might publish one this week or they might not, kind of thing. They didn't have regular publication dates. But it was kind of short-lived. There's one called the Wilmington Mercury that I've actually read different versions of it. You can get it online. And it was published in the 1790s. And it actually says on the front page of the paper, printed occasionally and delivered free. And so they weren't making any bones about it. Now, it lasted, you know, into the late 1790s. There was another newspaper called the Mirror of the Times. I think it started in 1799, but I would say the first real newspaper that had real news and a lot of it was probably a newspaper called the American Watchman, and that was in the 1800s, the early 1800s, and I've read a number of editions of that, and it really had a lot of news in it. You know, these other newspapers, they were published sporadically without a regular publication date, but they were available. And the fact that Wilmington sat along a major transportation route made this news pretty accessible to everybody.
So the average person in Wilmington in 1770, because of that, would you say word of mouth in the taverns, because that somebody traveling and then passing the word on, how long would it take for big news from Boston or Virginia to reach Wilmington, do you think?
Pretty fast. Of course, we also had the river, you know, had transportation on the rivers. Things went pretty fast. They had what they called express riders that would deliver letters and messages by horseback, kind of like the Pony Express. And so things actually moved pretty fast. I can give you an example from the early 1800s. E.I. DuPont's brother's name was Victor. And Victor was in Philadelphia for business in, I think it was 1827. This is a little bit later. And he died. He died there, collapsed on the street in Philly. And they knew by the next day they had news had reached here very quickly. And you're not that much further away from the colonial era. And I'm sure that you know, the taverns, especially, were big places to get news. And people went there every night to find out what was going on. So the fact that we had one decent road that ran up the whole East Coast really helped communications and help news travel.
Speaking of taverns, and since the Wilmington History Society meets at a tavern, the Chelsea Tavern, I want to ask you about the taverns that were present during this period. One thing that many people from Wilmington have heard over the years is the Ship's Tavern District, and that was even part of a marketing campaign by the city of Wilmington. Was there really a Ship's Tavern there during the colonial period, and what were some of the other notable taverns in the city at this time?
Well, first of all, yes, there was a Ship's Tavern. It actually was called the Sign of the Ship. We'll talk about it in a second here. But tavern life was absolutely essential to the social life and every other aspect of life in Wilmington, economic life, political life. I don't think we can overestimate the influence and the importance of taverns, and there were a lot of them in Wilmington. And, you know, we didn't have big box stores or fast food places or takeout restaurants, you know, or motels. This is all these things occurred in the taverns. They were centers of transportation. The stagecoach that existed during this time actually left from one of the taverns on Market Street. One of the taverns served as a post office. Before there was a city hall in Wilmington that was built in 1798, it's still down on Market Street, a lot of the official business of the town was conducted in a tavern. So these taverns were extremely important. The first one we know about was one that was down on Water Street, right on the Christina River, depending on what form you take. It was called the Foul Anchor. It was built in 1734 and actually stayed in business until about 1840. Now, as you moved up Market Street, you came up into the Ship's Tavern District, and of course the city or the town was really built around the maritime trade along the Christina River. So the sign of the Ship Tavern, it was located at 3rd and Market, and it was a very, very important tavern. And it had a lot of famous visitors. It stood, I think, until 1837, or thereabouts. And it was just probably the most important tavern in the town. Now, if you move further up, you went to 4th and Market, you had the Indian King Tavern. And then at 5th and Market, you had the Indian Queen Tavern. Now, the Indian Queen, the people of the day just shortened the name. They just called it the Queen. And if you go to that corner today at 5th and Market, we have another edifice that's called the Queen. And it's the direct descendant of the Indian Queen. So the Queen Theater that you see there today sits on the same location.
Same exact spot?
Same exact spot. Yeah, moving further up Market Street, you get up into the to sort of the top end of the town. And during the Revolutionary War period, you had really two critical taverns. The Cross Keys Tavern, which was at Delaware Avenue, really about Delaware Avenue and where the Brandywine Cemetery sits today. And then the Buck Tavern. Now, actually, the Buck Tavern was further downtown. It was at Front Shipley. But these two taverns, the Cross Keys and the Buck, kind of at either end of the town, were extremely important during the Revolutionary period, because they were one of the places where Washington and the Continental Army, the officers, met on a regular basis. In fact, I've actually seen in Washington's own handwriting, in his general orders, he orders court-martials to be conducted at both the Cross Keys and the Buck Tavern in August and in September of 1777, when the Continental Army was in Wilmington. So these were important places. The Cross Keys actually stayed in business until the Civil War, until about 1863. Not sure about the Buck Tavern. Now, if you moved over into Brandywine Village, there were two other taverns, the Green Tree Inn and the Brandywine Village Inn, that were very important. And they also hosted military officers during the Revolutionary War. Unfortunately, it was on the other side. The British and the Hessians, when they took possession of Wilmington, actually stayed in those taverns. The Green Tree Inn and the Brandywine Village, they both were opposite each other, right at Concord Avenue and North Market, if you know where that is today. Unfortunately, they don't exist anymore. It's a shame. The Brandywine Village Inn actually stood until 1931. And I have a picture of it, and it looked like it was in good shape, but it was torn down. It's a shame. You know, once you lose these historic buildings, you can't get them back.
That is true. And each of these taverns, are they producing their own alcohol themselves, or was there somebody that they were buying it from?
Well, we did have a brewery on Quaker Hill. One of the Shipley sons owned a brewery down there during this time, but each tavern generally produced its own beer. They had a thing called little beer back in the colonial period, and it was kind of like a really light beer, like maybe 2% alcohol. It was much safer to drink the beer than the water in colonial America, so you had a lot of beer consumption. So most of these inns had their own, and taverns had their own recipe for making beer. And they could make it just about out of anything, any kind of grain. Of course, Wilmington was loaded with grains because of the mills. You could make it from barley, from wheat, from rice. They even used spruce trees. That was a very famous beer, actually. In fact, I think there's a brewery up in Philly that still makes a spruce beer. So that was very important. And then, of course, in the evening, gathering these taverns, and there was a lot of drinking. Of course, it was rum. Wilmington had a very, very robust trade with the West Indies. We would take cornmeal down there and grains and probably haul back a lot of rum and molasses. So there was rum always to be found in these taverns. And then the most, I think, the kind of the favorite drink of the colonial era, at least in the Mid-Atlantic and up towards New England, was a thing called flip. And what flip was, you'd go into a tavern at night and they'd give you a tankard. They'd mix rum and beer and put some spices such as nutmeg or cinnamon in there, and then either cream or an egg. I know this doesn't sound very good, but they'd mix this all up. They'd get a hot poker and get it red hot, and they'd stick it into the tankard, and the thing would foam up. And apparently, it was very, very good, and it was a very, very popular drink. So the drink flip was very common in the colonial era. In fact, I've been in some places that are old colonial taverns, and you see these pokers on the fireplace, and I always thought they were for tending fire, but as I found out subsequently, they're really for making flip, for dipping into the flip. And you can still find it today. You can go on online and see recipes for it, and I guess it was a very, very popular drink.
Well, I think you've given us an idea for a drink at a future Wilmington History Society event, because it sounds like a very interesting and tasty drink. I want to go back to one of the other, after the revolution in France, many of the French aristocrats were kicked out. Some of them came to Wilmington, and you have a theory about the origins of French Street.
Yeah. Well, what happened is that during the Revolutionary War, we had a huge, huge maritime trade prior to the Revolutionary War. In fact, there was somewhere between 12 and 14 pretty sizable ships that came in on a regular basis in and out of the Christiana River that did overseas trade. And of course, we had other ships that just did trade with Philadelphia, Philadelphia being the largest port in the colonies. Anyway, all that went away during the Revolutionary War. The river was blockaded by the British, and maritime trade was just decimated. And it stayed that way until about 1791. And what happened in 1791 was revolution in Santo Domingo, or what we would call Haiti. This was a French colony. So there was about 25,000 French citizens living there at the time of the revolt. And concurrent with that was also the French Revolution back in France. And people that were monarchists, and I assume most of these people in Santo Domingo were monarchists, they couldn't go home to France, they couldn't stay in Haiti, so where did they go? They came to the United States, and a large, large number of them came to Wilmington. So in 1791, the economy of Wilmington really spiked. And I've read accounts of where people were renting out every available space they had. The prices of commodities went through the roof, milk, eggs, butter. But nobody seemed to complain because they were selling a lot of it here, and the French were buying it. And we got this huge French colony that moved to Wilmington. And the quotes that you see, there's that every house was rented, or every part of a house was rented. So the people in Wilmington did pretty well. And even E.I. DuPont, who founded the DuPont Company, you know, he comes up here about 1800, 1801, and what does he find? He finds a large French colony here. And besides the advantages of the river to turn his powder mills for power, I've seen letters that he wrote as one of the reasons that he came here is because there was a large French community. He felt very much at home. In fact, he had known some of these people prior to coming to Wilmington. So we had a large French community. Many of them settled along Willing Street, as it was called in the day, and they changed that name to French Street because there were so many French people living there. And then eventually what happened is Napoleon came to power, and he allowed these former monarchists to return to France. And a lot of the people that lived in Wilmington, a lot of the French people, actually moved on, and they moved back to France. But some of them did stay.
And you mentioned to me before that if they had stayed, you thought that the nature of Wilmington might have become more French. Is that right? And what would that have looked like? What would it meant if this significant French colony had stayed? How would that have? What would it? How
well,
would it?
You know, Wilmington. Yeah, Wilmington's gone through different periods of immigration, you know, where we had large influx of, you know, Irish people. We've had Germans, of course, Italian, Polish immigration, and this was the French immigration. And today we can see descendants of all the other immigrations, but you don't see too many from the French immigration. And I think had Napoleon not come to power, these people would have all stayed in Wilmington. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but Louis Philippe, who was the Duke of Orleans, was in Wilmington during this period. And, you know, he didn't live here, but he visited here a lot, and he had friends here in Wilmington. And he goes on to become the future King of France. You know, he was the King of France from 1830 to 1848. So, you know, theoretically, you know, guys like him would have stayed, and many, many other. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of French immigrants to Wilmington. And, of course, the DuPonts never did go back. They stayed. But you would have seen a lot more prominent French families stayed in Wilmington had not Napoleon come to power. So it would have, I think it would have changed a lot of things in Wilmington.
Yeah, certainly. I would have been in Wilmington if the alternative was to get my head cut off in France, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Let's talk about education. To what extent was there even what we would consider by today's standards an education system? To what extent was the average person, did they receive any formal schooling in colonial Wilmington?
Really didn't exist. What we think of as public education did not exist during a colonial period. I mean, you did have schools, but they were generally private schools, usually with a religious affiliation. So, for instance, the first school in Wilmington was established by the Society of Friends, the Quakers. They established the school on Shipley. I think it was between second and third, if I recall, on Shipley. And that school was established in 1748, and that was a school for Quaker children. In fact, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the Wilmington Friends School that's currently in Alapocas uses that date, 1748, and they trace their lineage back to this school from 1748. So that was the first school in Wilmington, and it was religiously affiliated. You'd call it a private school, I guess, today. So there really wasn't any public schooling in Wilmington at that point. Now, later on, after the Revolution, the State Assembly, did pass an act, and I think it was in 1796. And what they did is they dedicated money from the taxes that were collected for marriage licenses and, believe it or not, tavern licenses. And they took that money and they put it into a fund to establish the first rudimentary steps towards public education to schools. But I really don't think that the schools and public education as we know it really came in to existence until really into the 1800s, not really during the colonial period. There were schools, but generally they were private schools. And remember, you know, if you were a kid growing up in this era, your parents didn't think about education the same way parents do today. What they thought about was, how can I get my son or my daughter a position somewhere as an apprentice or learning a trade or a skill or a craft? And they did that quite early. You know, when they were 13 or 14 years old, they were apprenticed somewhere. And if they had education, that was fine. If they didn't, it was fine. They didn't think of it in the same way. And those that got higher education were generally from the upper class. George Washington, for instance, when he was raised as a young man, as a boy, his family had intended to send him back to England to get his higher education. And I think the Seven Years' War broke out, and he never did make it to England for his education. But that was pretty typical. You know, we were still a colony. We were still associated with a mother country then, and we put a lot of value in their educational institutions, at least their higher ones. We didn't really have that many here in the New World. So education, public education in Wilmington during this period really didn't exist.
Bill, I want to ask you about your interest in history. What led you to become interested in the topic of colonial and Revolutionary War history? I mean, there's so many topics out there, and I know you are interested in other topics because we've talked about them, but this is the big topic that you're doing research on and writing about and speaking about. What was it about this period that intrigued you so much?
Well, you know, growing up here as a kid, I have to tell you, I wasn't nearly as interested in history as I probably should have been. I went to Salesiana as a young kid, and I just had a wonderful history teacher. I'll give him a shout out. His name was Kevin McGonigal. And it was the one class I couldn't wait to go to because he made it so interesting. And what I had discovered as I got older is what a historic area we live in that we take for granted. The roads we drive on, the places we see today in Brandywine Valley all have some historical significance one way or the other, and it just requires us discovering it. And you know, I had kind of a long career in the Army and the military, and I got to go around the world and see some historical things, but I think we have the history we have in Delaware can compete with just about anywhere around the world. I think you know, it's fascinating, and now that I'm retired, I have the time to do it and look at it, research it, and it's been fun.
I'm glad you do it, because stuff you've dug up is really incredible, and I won't give it away, but I know you have some projects that you're kind of keeping a lid on for your own purposes until the time is ripe, but you're doing some, I think, incredible research. Transport, and I think we take it for granted how easy it is to get around these days. You can literally order a ticket and you can wake up one day in Wilmington, and then spur of the moment's notice you can wake up the next day in France or England. And that's not something that is fairly new. Some of the research I'm doing on Wilmington during World War II, I've been talking to a lot of people that grew up in the 20s and 30s, and overwhelmingly they tell me that it was a big deal to go to Philadelphia. That was the furthest that most of them went. What was it like, transport in the colonial era? How did people travel? What was the definition? What did people think of as a big, quote-unquote, trip?
Well, first, being from Wilmington, from Delaware, we had it better than most because we sat astride some pretty major transportation routes. First, we had some roads that connected us back in the colonial era. And the second thing, we had the river, or rivers, I should say. So we had a couple of advantages. One thing that jumps out at you when you do primary research about this era is you constantly come across diaries and journals, and people complain constantly about the roads. So the roads weren't in great shape, and it was a real struggle to get from one place to another. In Wilmington, I would highlight three roads that still exist today that generally follow the same tracks that they followed in colonial times that were absolutely essential to our economic life and to any kind of travel you had to do back in those eras. Let's start with the Philadelphia Pike. So I grew up in Bellefonte. Anybody from the Philadelphia Pike knows that, you know, it's got fast food, big box stores, and that's the way we think of it as sort of the post-industrial highway. But it was the main thoroughfare in colonial America. It was known as the King's Highway, and it ran from Boston 1,300 miles all the way down to Charleston, South Carolina. And it was the construction of the King's Highway began in the mid-1600s and was finished in the early 1700s. And every colony had to sort of do its part. And it was the one road that was they endeavored to keep up the maintenance on it and make sure it was serviceable for most of its life. And even that road deteriorated from time to time. But the King's Highway runs right into Wilmington, becomes North Market Street, and then runs right into the city. So anybody that was going anywhere in the colonies took the King's Highway, and that's one of the reasons Wilmington got so many famous visitors and why our taverns were so important and prominent. So that's one. The Concord Pike was another one, called the Great Valley Road, the Concord Road. Eventually became a pike. Now, when I use this term pike, it's short for turnpike. And Philadelphia Pike and the Concord Pike and then the Kennett Pike, you know, Route 52, were all eventually turnpikes, which means that they had a toll gate at one end and a toll gate at the other end, and you paid a toll to get on these turnpikes. And most of them became turnpikes 1811, I think the last one around 1812, 1813. And actually, Kennett Pike was a paying turnpike all the way up until April of 1919. So that was the way you got around if you really wanted to have some fast travel back in the day. But these three roads were prominent in the colonial period. They were absolutely essential to our economic life. We had these wonderful flour mills all started by Quakers, I might add, in Brandywine Village. And during the time of the American Revolution, there were eight of them putting out just probably the best flour in the United States, if not the world. It was called Brandywine Superfine Flour. They also ground cornmeal, grits, everything else there. But in order to get the raw material to the mills, they had to come down these pikes. They had to come down the Concord Road or the Kennet Pike. And we got corn and wheat from as far away as Bucks County and Lancaster County. You know, later on, a lot of this raw material came in by boat, but there was a time when the drovers brought in Conestoga wagons down these major thoroughfares, and they were just critical to the development, the economic growth of Wilmington. And they still exist today, and they generally follow the same track as they followed during the colonial times. The other great transportation hub we had, or transportation thoroughfare, was the river, the Delaware River. And we had passenger service on the river in colonial times, but it was by sail. But in 1812, the first steamship started running from Wilmington up to Philadelphia. And it was a passenger service that ran twice a day, once up and once back. I've been through some diaries, and it looks like the fare was about $1 to travel. What I can't pin down is the travel time, because I've read two different accounts, and what I have extrapolated is it took a lot longer to get to Philadelphia when you were fighting the current than it did to come back. I just read a couple days ago an account where a circuit priest, who was one of the first priests to work in Delaware, came down from Philly, and he claims it took him 4 hours and 10 minutes on the steam to come south. But then I've read accounts where going to Philly took up to 8 hours, so it could be kind of challenging if you were in a hurry. But it certainly had to be better than taking the stage, considering the state of the roads and the state of the suspension on these carriages back in the day. And we had Stagecoach from Wilmington, and it departed the Indian King Tavern on Market Street every day at 7 a.m., and it would be a four-hour trip to Philly, and then it was $1.50, and then it come back the other way. It left at 3 p.m. and arrived at 7 p.m. back in Wilmington. And there were two other stage routes. I think one ran to Annapolis, Maryland, and the other one ran to Baltimore, and they were slightly more expensive to take them, but that had to be a little bit rough traveling on the stage. I think if you had a choice, you'd want to be a little smoother ride out on the river.
I think I'd pick the river ride than the stagecoach. I want to ask you about the economy, and in particular, quote-unquote, big employers. Nowadays, every city is thinking in terms of who are the big employers that we have, who are the big employers that we can attract. What would have been the big employer of the colonial period, or employers? What did it take? How many employees did it would you have had to have had to be one of those?
Well, I'm going to not include the DuPont powder mills, because that really isn't, that's at the end of the colonial era, and really the early 18 to mid 1800s where they really got rolling. So I'll put him aside, because he was definitely a big employer. I would say there were two economic areas that drove the largest employment in Wilmington during the colonial era. I would say the maritime trade along the Christiana River, where we had ships, ship crews, ship captains, people to unload the ships, people to repair the ships. There is a time after the Revolution in 1793 where the smallpox epidemic broke out in Philly, and none of the ships wanted to go to Philly, so they all came to Wilmington. And when you read the accounts of, that's the second big boom after the Revolution. There's one quote I read that said one of the sweetest smelling things you smelled in Wilmington was boiling pitch and tar, because every single wharf was full, had ships. All the ships that were going to go to Philly came to Wilmington, and it was a big boom economically. So that maritime trade and all the related trades that went with it, sail making, ship repair, moving cargo, that had to be the single collectively biggest employer. I would say the second biggest, and this is just my opinion now. Yeah, I'm sure there's people out there that know more about this than I do, but I would say the mills over in Brandywine Village. There were eight of those mills. The first mill actually started producing flour in 1742. And by the time you get to the American Revolution, 76, 77, 1777, you had eight mills making a number of different products. And in those days, the products came in, the raw product came down the Pikes, as I talked about, but it also came in by ship. The Brandywine was actually navigable all the way up to where the Brandywine Bridge is today, where the mills are. I think there's condos there now, but they would actually bring the bags of flour and the bags of corn. They'd drop them off when the tide was in. They'd go back out. They would grind the product, and the ships would come back in and take it away. And when they really peaked there, they were producing between 300,000 and 500,000 bushels of wheat and corn per year. So that's a lot. And those mills would have employed, that was probably the biggest single employer outside of the maritime trade in Wilmington. So they were the two biggies, I would think. And, you know, you have eight mills. Eventually, I think I read that increased before the end of the 1700s to 14. And that's just flour and barley and grain mills. That doesn't include the other types of mills that were along the river. But that was a big economic boost. And those mills actually, they continued for 184 years, which is phenomenal when you think about it. I think the mills on the south side of the river, the Wilmington side, they stopped grinding in 1880, but there were some mills on the other side that continued. I think one mill continued to 1926. So that's quite a legacy.
Yeah, that is. Any company that stays in business that long is quite impressive. How did a typical worker at these mills, how were they compensated? Did they get a salary? Were they working for food? Or what was, and were there workers' rights, as that term would be understood today?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to find a lot of workers' rights back in those days. I mean, we've come so far when it comes to protecting workers' rights and collective bargaining and unions and everything like that. None of that existed back then. The owners of the mills, you'd recognize all these names. I mean, Canby, Tatnall, Lee, Shipley, Shawcross, all Quakers. And they had certain moral and religious underpinnings, which probably made them pretty good employers. They did believe in treating people well, but I don't think you would see anything like the protections that exist today. And their workers, I've read descriptions, the workers were, a lot of them were Irish or English. And I think it was Joseph Tatnall used to complain that they drank too much, and he wished he had more Frenchmen that were his workers. But they didn't have workers' comp or anything that we would consider standard today. It was pretty rough. Now, as you got into the early 1800s and the DuPont mills came online, I do know that they had a lot of industrial accidents. They had a lot of explosions at the DuPont mills, and I know there were at least three that were pretty bad. In fact, one killed 35 people in 1818. And I have read letters where Mr. DuPont made sure that every single family got an annuity, got a death benefit and an annuity for the rest of their lives for those workers that were killed. Now, he wasn't doing that because of the law. He was doing that because he was a good employer. Imagine you could have a bad employer and you were just out on the street because there really wasn't any legal protection for those folks. But he was famous, I think, for taking pretty good care of his employees.
Yeah. Crime and law enforcement, kind of similar theme of my questions today. We think of crime and law enforcement in a certain context today, but did they, back in those days, was there a police force? What was the system in place to assure order?
Yeah, when Wilmington got its charter in 1739, it then was authorized to appoint constables or like a sheriff. They had a head constable and assistant constable. So that was your law enforcement, the constables. However, we didn't have courts. The courts were in Newcastle. So if you got a guy that violated the law, or regulation or whatever in Wilmington, you had to hold them until you could take them to Newcastle to be adjudicated. So what that produced at Third and Market was a thing called the cage. And a cage was built, a 12-foot square jail, if you will, and it had a nickname called the Smokehouse, and I can only imagine why they called it the Smokehouse. So let's say you were a violator. Let's say you were a drunkard or you did something antisocial and you got put, you got arrested by a constable and put in the Smokehouse. You would be held in the Smokehouse until they could be transported to Newcastle. And I'm sure a court wasn't in session every day, so I don't know whether it's every 2 weeks or every month they had the hearings down in Newcastle. Then they went down because Wilmington was only a borough. It wasn't authorized courts yet. So we had also two stocks and a whipping post at the same location. Now, interestingly enough, I've read in some accounts that Wilmington, the Burgess, could kick somebody out of the city. Didn't have to go to the courts for that. And it was called being drummed out of the city. And apparently it was a pretty ragged affair. And there was at least one historian, Benjamin Ferris, who wrote a lot about Wilmington. He was born in 1780, and I think he died during the Civil War. So he would have seen a lot of things the late part of this era. He considered it, quote, a violation of decency and humanity, this drumming ceremony that they did. And what they actually do, they would take a guy out of the cage, they had a drummer would show up, they'd have a parade, they would announce it, and they would parade him out of the city. And apparently a lot of young people would line up with eggs and tomatoes and everything else, and this poor person would be abused all the way out of the city. And they would take him actually to Brandywine Bridge, and over the bridge and drummed out of Wilmington. And I guess it became Brandywine Village's problem at that point. But Benjamin Ferris did not like this practice, and it eventually was outlawed, and he considered it a cruel and inhuman punishment.
Any record of,
if you will, but basically crime. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You were about to finish.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, there was crime. Certainly, I've read diaries where people were robbed, you know, especially out in the country. There was a circuit priest, a guy named Father Patrick Kenny, who's got a wonderful diary that provides a wonderful insight into life in Wilmington during this period of time. And a couple of times he was robbed, and he wasn't too happy about it. And just was one of those things you're sort of on your own when you're out in the on the road. He ministered at one point to a young kid. I think he was from Liverpool, England, and he was accused of murdering a girl in Wilmington. And he was put in jail in Newcastle and sentenced to hang. So there was a death penalty, and I won't get all the details, but eventually he was pardoned. They didn't have enough evidence. The priest puts in his diary. I think the priest in the diary kind of implies he thought he was innocent anyway, and it was a good outcome all around. But they did have a death penalty.
Phil, what buildings still stand today from the colonial period that people can see if they're interested in the architecture?
There's a few good ones that you can see. Of course, you can go to the City Hall, which is right at the Wilmington Historical Society, right down on Market Street. That was built in 1798 and had some pretty interesting things happen there. The Marquis de Lafayette had a big dinner up on the second floor when he visited Wilmington. George Washington stayed in a house at 3rd and West, and unfortunately that house doesn't exist anymore. But there are some adjacent houses that must have certainly housed his staff at the time. So if you drive up West Street, you can see those houses right at the corner of 3rd and West, and they're really, really pretty houses. They're occupied today, and the people take very good care of them. But one look, and you know you're looking back at history. They're really something. You can also see some houses at the Delaware Historical Society. You mentioned Willingtown, whatever they call the little square there, right across from the Delaware Historical Society. And they have a square there where they've moved houses from different parts of the city. And some of those houses date back to the 1740s, and they're a really great example of what Wilmington looked like back in the colonial area. And they're well worth going down and checking out. There's a church down in Brandywine Park along Park Avenue at Adams and Park Street. It's the First Presbyterian Church. And it didn't always exist at that location. It was actually up at 10th and Market and moved to that location in the 1920s. And that church was used as a hospital for British soldiers after the Battle of Brandywine. The British came into Wilmington. They had so many wounded from the battle that they occupied Wilmington to move their wounded out by ship. And they turned a lot of facilities here into hospitals while they were here. And that was one of them. You can see that, and it's still pretty well preserved. If you head out North Market Street and get onto the Philadelphia Pike, and you head up the Philadelphia Pike up Penny Hill, which used to be called Shellpot Hill back in the day, You can look on the left between Shipley and Marsh, and you can see the Arthur Penny House, and it still stands. That house was built in 1749, and it's still there. And there are accounts where Washington, Lafayette, many other famous people stopped there to water horses and get water for themselves. Of course, it sat right on the King's Highway, so it was a natural place to stop, but you can see that. I think one of the interesting things to me that you can see, if you know where to look, if you get down at the foot of Adams Street, right along the Brandywine River, and you're looking across at the Brandywine Zoo, there was a ford placed across the river right there at that location. And that's how people got back and forth in the early colonial period, because the Brandywine Bridge really didn't exist till the late 1760s. So if you were coming down North Market Street or the King's Highway into the town of Wilmington, you had to do a little dogleg over to where the zoo is and cross the river right there with your wagon or your horse or your body. And you can still see where the ford was at that location. There's one other location outside the city. Go up Pennsylvania Avenue to the intersection of Route 52, Kennett Pike, and Center Road. And if you look to the left, you can see, if you look close, there's an old tavern called the Crooked Billet. In fact, they're making an over 55 sort of retirement community in there now. They're calling it the Crooked Billet. And if you look back in there, you can see the original Crooked Billet. And George Washington stopped in the Crooked Billet on his way to the Brandywine battlefield. It still stands. I think it was in the DuPont family for about 200 years and only had a couple of owners. But it's still there. It's just kind of hard to see, but if you look close enough, you can see it. There are many other places, but there's just a few of the places that still exist today.
I actually want to add one to the list that I discovered recently and confirmed it yesterday, after we spoke yesterday. It's at the intersection of Lovering Avenue and Union Street, and it wasn't there during the colonial period, but I believe it's the Delaware Medical Association. And it was built, the building was built in 1798, but it was downtown at one period, and it was in an area that was marked for modern office building, and it was moved brick by brick. Are you familiar with this building?
I am. And I think the first president of that association was John McKinley, who was also the first president of Delaware. He was, elected the first president of Delaware, governor. He was also a doctor, and I do believe he was the president of that medical association. I don't know if he was in that building at any time, but I'm familiar with it. It's a beautiful building.
It is. I've never been inside, but I double-checked last night. I was out for a walk, and the front says 1798, and it looks like there was an addition in 1865. But of course, during the colonial period, that area would have been wilderness. So, Bill, let me kind of close with one last question. There's an old phrase familiar to many generations that says, Washington slept here. And every town in the East Coast jokingly makes that claim. I believe the Deer Park Tavern in Newark, which I know I spent a lot of time there when I was at UD, I don't know if you did, also makes that claim. Did George Washington actually sleep in Wilmington? And are there any other famous figures of the era definitely pinpoint as being in the city of Wilmington?
Well, if there's one thing Wilmington can claim, hands down, without a doubt, is that George Washington definitely slept here. In fact, I can list three separate locations in the city that are prominently associated with George Washington. Of course, the first is at 3rd and West, where he had his headquarters in August and September of 1777. The Crooked Billet, which I just talked about, during that period of time, Washington had the army in Wilmington, and he moved them down to Red Clay Creek in Stanton. And then when it became obvious that the British were going to head towards Chad's Ford, he moved the army. And in moving the army, he stopped at the Crooked Billet, the one I just explained. In fact, there's a historian, Elizabeth Montgomery, I want to read this quote, because she talks about it in her book on Wilmington. The Crooked Billet was later owned by a guy named James Brindley. So in her quote, she mentions his name. Here it is. The old mansion of James Brindley on this side of the Brandywine claims our passing notice because here General Washington took his breakfast on the morning of the Battle of the Brandywine, walking the floor in deep thought or standing with his cup of coffee in his hand, eating little, and soon hastening on to Chad's Ford. And she goes on to say that the descendants of James Brindley actually have a lock of Washington's hair from that time. So that's a place where George Washington, he didn't sleep there, but he was definitely in it. Where another place he did sleep was the sign of the Ship Tavern, which we've already talked about. And after the war, of course, Washington was our first president, and he had to travel between Mount Vernon, Virginia, and Philadelphia, which was the capital. So when he used the King's Highway, he came right through Wilmington, and he would stop and he would stay at the sign of the Ship. I happened to be going through some obscure paper that's on file at Catholic University of America. It's about the Irish in America. And I came up with an amazing quote on that paper. And it refers to a Colonel Lear, who was an aide to George Washington. And he's talking about Washington in the sign of the Ship Tavern. The tavern was owned by a Revolutionary War veteran, a guy named Captain Patrick O'Flynn. And listen what Colonel Lear said. Quote, that in all his journeys with the president, he had never seen him so much at home in a public house as in Captain O'Flynn's. And of course, Captain O'Flynn's was the sign of the Ship. So Washington stayed at the sign of the Ship. In fact, I've actually read some sources where they talk about the actual room he stayed in on the second floor, and they kept it as kind of a shrine or a monument into the mid-1800s, so people could visit and see where Washington had stayed. But he came through Wilmington many times. There was another good anecdote where he stopped at Joseph Tatnall's house on North Market, 1803 North Market Street, and he went down into the Tatnall wasn't home, so he went down into the mill to visit him, to thank him for all he had done, grinding flour for the Continental Army. But now Washington definitely was in Wilmington. There's many other things, many artifacts, maps, and orders that he wrote when he was in Wilmington, and I've seen a lot of the primary source material. So that, you know, we can say that Washington definitely slept here. Now, in the sign of the Ship, you also had John Adams, you had Thomas Jefferson when he was the vice president, stayed there. Commodore Perry, the hero of the battle, one of the battles in 1812 on Lake Erie, and many other notables. I mean, we had a lot of famous people come through here.
Well, George Washington, I think, leads us into the fascinating topic of the American Revolution and the role that Wilmington played in it, and which is a perfect topic for a future podcast. So, Bill, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts on Colonial Wilmington, and I look forward to meeting up with you again and doing the second podcast on the Revolutionary War era.
My pleasure, Nathan.